And so he got Melville out of the way, as we described at the end of the last hour. And the bishops they already had there were just sort of superintendents. They didn't actually have much power, but James tried to increase their power in Scotland. And in 1520, he made a trip up to Scotland in order to try to, particularly to get the churches there more under control of the king, as so many of them were already in England. We'll see more about the relation with Scotland late next semester, which was very important in the bringing on of the tremendous development in the middle of that 17th century. So now we'll briefly mention small e, an incident in James's career, which is more important in connection with the history of continental Europe, so we will look at it in some detail in that connection next semester. But we'll simply mention here, we call small e the Synod of Dort. The Synod of Dort, D-O-R-T, or if you prefer, Dordrecht, D-O-R-D-R-E-C-H-T. Dort or Dordrecht is a city in Holland. And there was a great controversy in Holland, a controversy which was the beginning of the movement known as Arminianism. We will look back next semester a little at the life of Arminius and the events that led up to the Synod of Dort and the various discussions at that meeting. The important thing now is that this synod, while actually James felt that he was helping the Calvinists by sending English representatives over there, the result of it was to introduce Arminianism into England. It's, of course, maybe the synod would have done that even without his sending representatives, because this was a new movement against Calvinism, and all those who were against Calvinism for any reason, not merely for doctrinal reasons, seized on this during this next few years. But James sent four English representatives to this synod, with the Dutch had invited people from the Reformed churches all over Europe to come to. The French Reformed Church appointed representatives, but the King of France refused to allow them to keep to leave the country. However, there were representatives from other Reformed churches there, as well as England, though the great body were from Holland. After this Synod of Dort, those in England who opposed the strong biblical emphasis of the Puritans began to seize on the name Arminian. And they were, many of them, men who got into high positions in the church. And while the biblical preachers in England were practically all Calvinists at this time, there were men put into high ecclesiastical positions who were very strongly of a more Catholic viewpoint. That is, not Catholic in the original sense of the word, but Catholic in the sense of getting nearer to the Romanist doctrine. And somebody asked someone about the time of James' death, or a little later, somebody said, "What do the Arminians hold?" And the answer that was given him was, "Most of the top positions in the Church of England." That was what the Arminians held. While the body of the ministers who were wide awake and alert were strong Calvinists at this time, the official position came more and more to be put into the hands of people with quite a different viewpoint. Now that's E. Then F, briefly look at, mentioned the Book of Sports, 1618. While James was theoretically very Calvinistic in his theology, one thing he disagreed with the Calvinists was their emphasis on the keeping of the Lord's Day. And so in 1618, James had prepared what he called the Book of Sports. It was a statement that would take maybe 10 or 15 minutes to read, urging the people that on Sunday they should gain relaxation and amusement with playing games, having cockfights and various other entertainments. And he ordered that this should be read in every pulpit in the land. And this aroused great protest. This insistence that every church must read this Book of Sports, urging the people to break the solemnity of the Sabbath day. Then small g, the rise of Laud, L-A-U-D, the rise of Laud. We have noticed the various archbishops, beginning with the beginning of Elizabeth's reign. Notice how different in character, and how under Elizabeth she was such a powerful ruler that if they did not have the same ideas she did, she forced them into line. And by the end of her reign, she had Whitgift, who was entirely not merely anxious to do what she wanted, but thoroughly convinced that what she wanted was right. And the same was true of Bancroft, who was the archbishop during the first 6 years of James's reign. Then we notice that for some reason, James appointed Archbishop Abbott in 1610, who was a strong Calvinist, one who favored sermons, favored Bible study, favored the biblical emphases, although he was devoted to the king's leadership and supremacy, and in many ways very pleasing to the king. For the last 10 years of Abbott's life, he was simply sort of shunted into the background and made a mere ceremonial figure. But during those 10 years, the man who really exerted the power of archbishop and who succeeded Abbott as archbishop was a man named Laud, L-A-U-D. William Laud is a man who is very important in the subsequent development in the history of Puritanism in England. He was perhaps as strong a religious opponent as Puritanism has ever had. He was a well-educated man, a man who had strongly opposed the Puritan leadership while he was in the university and while he was in various positions in the church. He was devoted to the supreme power of the king. He was insistent that the king's authority was should be absolutely paramount, but probably much more important than that to him was the fact that he had an entirely different conception of the church than the Puritans had. His conception is today known as Anglo-Catholic. And Laud's idea was that the Church of England was like the Church of Rome, that it was a church which differed comparatively little in its doctrine, certain amount, but not a great deal from the Church of Rome. But the Church of Rome was the church of the area in Italy. The Church of England was the church of the area in England. And each of these was a true church because its ministry had been consecrated by men who had consecrated them and so on. He held right back to the apostles. And therefore he held that the important thing in the church was that it had certain ceremonies, certain forms, and a certain continuity. And to this day, in the Church of England, the ministers of the Church of Sweden are welcome in the pulpits of the Church of England because Sweden has the apostolic succession, supposedly. But the ministers of the Church of Denmark are not allowed to speak in churches of the Church of England because in Denmark at the Reformation there was a complete break. Luther appointed new leaders for the Church of Denmark. Actually, in belief and attitude, at the 17th century, Denmark and Sweden were absolutely identical. But this break in the continuity, according to Laud and these others, constituted it not a true church. And consequently, Laud threw his whole influence against association with and fellowship with the Protestant churches of the continent and insisted that their real fellowship was with the churches, like the Church of Rome, which claimed to have an apostolic succession right from the time of the apostles. Now, Laud soon came to the attention of King James and others, and eventually, for the last 10 years that Abbott was archbishop, Laud was the real power. And after Abbott's death, Laud was made archbishop of Canterbury. Laud, one of the first positions that he was given of importance was a position in the Diocese of Gloucester. And here at Gloucester, the bishop was one of the translators of the King James Version. This man named Smith was the writer of the preface and also of the introduction to the dedication of the King James Version. Now, somebody has said it is very unfortunate, and it is indeed a shame, that in the great bulk of the copies of the King James Version that have been printed in this century, the dedication which Smith wrote has been printed, but the preface has usually not been printed. Actually, though the same man wrote them, they are very different. The dedication tells about the marvelous shining of the great sun over England when James became king, and what a marvelous gift it was to all humanity to have him, and how they praise him for his all he means to England, and so they dedicate the version to him. I don't think many people have read it in recent years, but it has often been reprinted, and I suppose it was necessary to hold James's favor. But the preface that Smith wrote was really an excellent piece of work in which he described the methods and approaches that they took in making the King James Version, told how they expected criticism, but how they had done their best, that they had not been trying to replace a bad version by a good one, but out of many good versions to make a better version. It is well worth your reading any time, is this preface to the King James Version. Now, this was written by this this learned man named Smith, and he was one of the translators of the version who was rewarded by being made a bishop. And so Smith became the Bishop of Gloucester. But the time came when King James sent William Laud to take over the leadership in the cathedral in Gloucester, and he told him that the Diocese of Gloucester was the worst-run diocese in all of England, and he wanted him to improve conditions there. And what Laud did at Gloucester was a good example of what he did with what he did when he became Archbishop of Canterbury, what he tried to do throughout all England. He said that when he came into Gloucester, he found that the altar in the cathedral was simply used as a table. It was in the middle of the church and was used as a table generally, although they would put the communion elements on it when they had communion, but otherwise they didn't pay any particular honor to the table, and he found that they had a great many sermons, and they had very little ceremony, and they didn't wear all the garments and special ceremonial clothes that he felt were important, and he set to work to change all that. And so he ordered the altar moved over to the east end of the building, and there in a prominent place he had the altar put. And he gave orders that whenever any of the ecclesiastics would enter the building, they must bow towards the altar. And he greatly increased the amount of ceremonial and cut down on the number of sermons and ordered to do away with services, special services, which they often had, where they had Bible lectures. Because all over England at this time, they were doing the ceremonies that were required by the royal command, and often you have a handful of people for the ceremony, and then after the ceremonial was over, then either the minister himself or a visiting lecturer would come in, and they would have a Bible lesson, and maybe 10 times as many people would crowd into the church for the lecture of an hour or two explaining the Bible as had been there for the sermon. Well, Laud was determined to change all that, and while he aroused considerable opposition within Gloucester itself, and he was theoretically under the bishop. He had the king in back of him, and so he was able to put through in Gloucester what he wanted, and he was then made Bishop of London, and he was very active in London. In London, there were by this time under Abbott, there had become established about 15 independent churches, many of them people who under Bancroft had fled to Holland and had been living as refugees in Holland, but under Abbott they had returned to England, and there were about 15 independent churches meeting somewhat secretly in London, because while everyone in England was required to go to the regular church services, it was illegal to hold other services. But in a big city like London, it was very difficult to enforce this altogether. Well, Laud set to work to try to cut down the attendance and the meetings of any churches that were not carrying through the ceremonials and acting as a definite part of what he considered to be the true Catholic Church, which had the apostolic succession right straight down his claim from the time of the apostles. Well, this so much for James's reign. We will mention number four now, the first part of the reign of Charles I. The first part of the reign of Charles I. Now, Charles, the son of James, reigned from 1525 to 1549. What we have noticed of Laud's activity, backed up by James, and later backed up by Charles, shows that probably Protestantism would have been utterly destroyed in England if the Stuarts had had anything like the ability that the Tudor rulers had had. Yes? 1416. We're in the 17th century now. 1625 to 1649. Thank you. Yes? The first of the Stuarts was James I, who was the family of Stuart, had reigned in Scotland for some centuries. And he was King James VI of Scotland, and then he was King James I of England. Scotland and England, by the way, were at this time two distinct countries. They had one ruler, because James, King of Scotland, had been made King of England. But the two were entirely distinct countries for another century after this. Their only connection being that the one man was king over both. And it was a century later that they were combined into one country. But even today, the people of London usually consider the people of Scotland as foreigners. And the legal system of the two countries is distinct even to this day. So the Parliament in London runs both of them, has since the early 1700s. But the Stuart rulers, James I and Charles I, and then his later successor, his son Charles II, there was a break in between, we'll look at some detail later, and James II, these Stuart rulers were far less able than the Tudor rulers before. What these rulers wanted to have in a way of complete monarchical authority, the Tudors had really had. King Henry VIII and Queen Elizabeth had had. They had ruled absolutely as they desired. Their ability was tremendous and their power was much greater than the Stuarts ever succeeded in having. But the Stuarts spent a great deal of time talking about the divine right of kings, while the Tudors devoted themselves to get done that what they wanted to have done. And so the Tudors were able to use all the different mechanisms that had developed in English government during previous centuries to accomplish what they wanted. And the result was that only on a few occasions did they simply give orders and make laws on their theoretically on their own initiative. They would tell the Parliament what they wanted, and the Parliament would usually do what they wanted. They were able to lead very effectively, often in a direction different from what the leaders of the Parliament might have desired. And, of course, if people opposed them, they often had them imprisoned or executed. And their power was very arbitrary in many ways, but they used all these forms, and they were very charming, and they managed to lead people along and please them. The Stuarts had this mechanism there that had grown up in England, and which the Tudors had done nothing to tear down, but had worked through. But the Stuarts didn't know how to handle it as well as the Tudors had. And the result was that Charles actually lost his head. That is, he had his head cut off in 1649 when he came into real opposition to Parliament. But we're at present looking at the first third of the century, and so we are interested now simply in the beginning of Charles' reign. And Charles, when he became king, was determined to carry on the policies the same as his father had done. He did not have as much ability as his father, but he was a much steadier sort of man than his father. James was more erratic, as shown, for instance, by his appointing Archbishop Abbott, who really did not share his ideas and desires. Charles was more steady in moving in the direction that he wanted, and as I say, not as able as his father. In some ways, a more attractive man, And like his father, had a tendency to have favorites who would let do almost anything they wanted, and they were not always the best type of men. But James had had difficulty with getting the money for the things he wanted to do, because there had developed in England the custom of having taxes voted by the Parliament. And it was not the custom by this time that the king could simply levy a tax. The Parliament was expected to do it. And under the Tudors, the Parliament generally did what they wanted. But under the Stuarts now, they began to have difficulty with the Parliament voting the money that they wanted. And so the result was that early in Charles's reign, Charles called a Parliament. Parliament could not come, couldn't have a Parliament except if the king called it. But Charles called a Parliament, and the Parliament, instead of immediately voting him the money he wanted, the taxes he wanted, made a declaration of their rights, declaring that the king had no right to seize people and imprison them without the action of the court, that he had no right to levy taxes on his own initiative, various other statements, and the result was that Charles dismissed the Parliament, and for a period of more than 10 years, he ruled without ever calling him a Parliament. And according to Winston Churchill, England was better ruled during these years when Charles ruled autocratically than it was in the times when Parliaments were ruled. And the Winston Churchill's history of the English-speaking people, that this is not many years ago. But I don't think the bulk of the English people felt that way about it. Charles, in order to get the money that he needed, he levied, he tried to raise what they called ship money. It had been customary that in order to defend the port, the people in the ports would give money to build ships to protect the port. Well, Charles said, it is fine that the people do that in the ports, but why should not all England participate? And so he began asking people all over the country to give money for ships. And this wasn't a tax, it simply was money given in order to build ships, and then Charles would use the money as he might desire. And he began asking people that had considerable money to make a gift to the king. And the people knew that there were many ways the king could harass them if they did not do it. And so, alongside of the changes that they were trying to make in the churches, there was also this movement for greater absolutism, which aroused many of the people of England, particularly the people in the mercantile classes, the people who had who were making money or who were active in these ways. They came to feel that they were being oppressed by the king and developed considerable opposition to him. All this time, during Abbott's time as Archbishop, the Puritans had gained tremendously in numbers. And now there were many in the universities who were studying the Bible avidly and writing long books discussing all sorts of matters of theology and biblical study. During this century, the Puritan writings, the tremendous amount of material that was written, a careful study of doctrinal and biblical matters. Some of those men simply lived for their study, many of them did. And the amount they wrote is tremendous, and the influence of Puritanism was spreading through the land, even though the king was more and more taking over the control of the church and trying to enforce his desires upon the nation. So things were heading up to an explosion which had results in several directions that has been very important in their effect still up to the present day. Now, capital B is going to A, was Great Britain in the first third of the century. The century divides rather neatly into three thirds in Great Britain, in the religious history of Great Britain. But in the continent of Europe, it divides rather naturally into two halves. And so capital B is going to be continental Europe during the first half of the 17th century. I'm not going to try to go very far into this first half of the century now in the little time we have left this semester, but rather at this point to take a glance at the condition of Europe at the beginning and at the during the first third of the 17th century. So remind you what we've already looked at to help review to some extent for the examination and to give a background for what we're going into at the beginning of next semester about. Now, we spent most of last semester on the 16th century, as great a century as the Christian church has ever seen, the century in which the Great Reformation occurred. At the beginning of the 16th century, as we noticed, you had the gospel known to little groups of people in just about every part of Europe. But you had the great mass of the people of Europe either in utter ignorance or in superstition. And the widespread superstition was being disseminated throughout the country, throughout the continent. So here and there, there were little groups of earnest Christians in every country at the beginning of the 16th century, about 1500 A.D. Now, the result of the Reformation was that the biblical understanding that was confined to a few people here and there at the beginning of the century, by the end of the century, was known to hundreds of thousands, but particularly in Northern Europe. And in Southern Europe, which, like Northern Europe, at the beginning of the century, had had the church in a very corrupt situation in which most of the officials were looking out only for their own pleasure, their own personal personal honor and ambition, it was by the end of the century the Counter-Reformation had seized hold of Southern Europe to such an extent that instead of having a few groups here and there where the gospel was being really understood, it was practically impossible to present in Southern Europe by the end of the century. In Spain, the very good little start the Reformation had made had been destroyed, and all the members of the churches tortured to reveal the names of all other members, and then all of them burned at the stake, and it had been wiped out of Spain, so that it was hardly possible to hear it at all for the next 13 centuries. The same had happened in Italy, and by the end of the century, it wasn't quite that way in Austria. By the middle of the century, Lutheran teaching had been very widespread in Austria. By the end of the century, great efforts were being made by the Habsburgs to eradicate Lutheran teaching and Calvinistic teaching from Austria, but they had not yet succeeded in their endeavors there. In Switzerland, of course, all of northern Switzerland was strongly Protestant by the end of the century, and mostly Calvinistic. In Germany, the northern part of Germany was largely strongly Lutheran, as was the Scandinavian countries. The southern part of, the middle part and somewhat western section of Germany, there were a great many Calvinists. In France, at the end of the century, there was a very strong Reformed church. You remember that the Huguenots had grown in France, despite the persecution and the attacks, to be an extremely large group. And finally, when Henry III died, and Henry IV, Henry of Navarre, who was the leader of the Huguenots, toward the end of the century, was the next one in line for the French throne, most of France was in his hands. But in Paris, the Jesuits had filled the people with fanaticism to where it was absolutely impossible for the Protestant forces to take Paris. And then Henry said, after a long effort to take Paris and become King of France, he said, "What is France without Paris?" He said, "Paris is worth a mass." And so he, toward the end of the 16th century, Henry announced his desire to enter the Roman Church. And he said, "I can help my fellows, my Huguenot friends. I can give them support and help as king, and I can become king by becoming a Roman." And one of the ministers, one of the priests in a church in Paris said, he said, "My dog went to mass this morning, let's make him king of France." And they were saying, "Why should you recognize Henry? He's insincere in becoming a Romanist. He's just doing it to become king." But the Jesuit said, "We must take the man at his word. If he says it, we must accept what he says. It's true." And they supported making him king. This ended the wars that France was being harassed by during the previous time when they were trying to destroy Protestantism in France, but it meant that Henry's children were raised by the Jesuits. And so now Henry became King of France, and then he established this Edict of Nantes. In this Edict of Nantes, he had a guarantee to the Protestants forever. It was permanent. It was irrevocable. He had guaranteed to them freedom from persecution. They were allowed to have any position in the government to which they might be chosen. They were not to be discriminated against. They were not to build their churches in the main parts of many of the cities of Paris, but they had one of France, but they had 100 cities in which they had control. And they had about 20 cities in which they were allowed to have garrisons at government expense to protect them against any renewal of the wars or any attacks upon them. And so, during the part of the century, the first part now of this century, you had Henry reigning, nominally a Roman Catholic, but giving protection to the Protestants. Leaders in his government were Protestants, and the Protestants had these garrisons, these fenced cities, and did all this to make it them safe forever. That was the situation at the beginning of the 17th century. By the end of the 17th century, 400,000 of the finest people of France had to flee and leave the country, or else to give up their religion, or else to be imprisoned. Some were living in the mountains as refugees. Many were imprisoned. Protestantism was practically wiped out of France by the end of the century. But in this part, at the beginning of the century, the Reformed Church of France was one of the great Protestant churches. It was a church which had the greater part of southern France had almost complete control of, and which had many churches in all parts of France, and had many of its members who were very prominent in the government. But the Jesuits had the training of the King's Church, and this is what brought about the change. It came about gradually. It came about gradually, partly because when Henry IV was assassinated by a man who had been trained by the Jesuits, his young son, Louis XIII, who took over, was a lazy, shiftless sort of fellow, and the real power fell into the hands of John Armand de Plessis, better known as Richelieu, Cardinal Richelieu. And Cardinal Richelieu was a very skillful and very patient man. And he did not set to work to destroy Protestantism. He set to work to build up the power of the king. His idea was to make the king supreme in France and to make France supreme in Europe. And in doing this, he laid the foundation which, in another 50 years, resulted in a king who was completely under the hands of the Jesuits and who had such complete power that he could utterly destroy the Protestant church in France. If Richelieu had tried to act precipitately or hastily, he would have been defeated. But he had great patience, and the Protestants, who were so grateful to the king for giving them this toleration, rather foolishly allowed their support to go to the power and strength of the king. And if their power helped in making the king supreme. Richelieu sent messages of congratulation to the Reformed Church when it had its meetings, and thanked them for their loyal support of the government, and treated them, gave them honors in these ways. But, Richelieu said, it is not right that they should have their private army. After all, we're one nation, we can all trust one another. There's no reason why any of us should be suspicious of others. He said the Huguenots should give up their private army and give up their defenses of their cities because the government will defend them. And the result was that he succeeded simply in getting rid of the private armies of the Protestants and in destroying their fortifications, but otherwise continued their privileges exactly as they were. And gradually over a period of 60 years, the Romanists, under skillful management, cut down the power of the Protestants to the point where Louis XIV eventually could be utterly destroyed. But that, of course, came at the latter half of the century. So that's the situation you had in France at this time. Now, in Holland at this time, you had a section which had come into the power of the King of Spain through the marriage alliances that had been made a century before, the Duke of Burgundy's daughter having married the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, and their son having married the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella. You had the King of Spain, who controlled Spain and also controlled what are now Belgium and Holland and also the northern part of France. And in this region, Philip II of Spain had tried to utterly destroy Protestantism. His father, Charles V, had had many Protestants burned and had used a great deal of oppression against them, but had managed to maintain his personal popularity all through the country. But Philip II was unable to do that. Philip was not like Richelieu. He was precipitous. He wanted to destroy this terrible thing that he understood Protestantism to be. And the result was that all of the Netherlands, Belgium and Holland, and the northern part of France was in revolt against him. And it took about 40 years before the matter was finally ended. This constant war between the troops of Spain and the people of these areas. Tens of thousands of them massacred in situation after situation that developed. And finally, the troops of Spain got control of the southern half of the area, while the northern half gained its independence. And the result was that this area was split in two parts, with the northern part centering around the province of Holland, coming to be known as Holland or the Netherlands, and it gained its independence and was under strong Protestant leadership, but had a very large Roman Catholic group in it, which had joined with the others for the sake of their freedom from the oppression of the King of Spain. And the result was that there was established more religious toleration in Holland than any country in the world had seen up to that time. And so during most of the time since that, there has been with a few small periods of when there was a change, but during most of it, there has been a great measure of toleration in Holland, religious toleration from that time to the present. The great, largest group in Holland were strong Calvinists, so there was also a sizable Roman Catholic group that was strongly opposed to the King of Spain. But the southern half of the area, the King of Spain had gained control of and put the Jesuits in complete direction over. So while he had to allow many of the people to migrate, those who did not migrate had to either could not be Protestant. And the Jesuits so trained the next generations in Belgium that there was, up until the beginning of the present century, there was practically no gospel preaching in Belgium. In Belgium, the ignorance of the Bible was about as complete at the beginning of our present century now as in any part of the world. It's just across the border from Holland, which was so utterly different. And they have been one country speaking one language and one type of people, and in fact, the greatest prosperity had been in the Belgian section before those wars. But after the wars, the prosperity largely went into Holland. So this little section became, for a brief time, one of the strong powers of the world after they gained their independence from Spain. And so at the beginning of our present century we're looking at, the 17th century, we have in Holland a truce, a 12-year truce which had been made, in which the King of Spain had agreed that for 12 years there would be no further attempt to conquer Holland. There was a truce made, which really was the beginning of their independence. And then you had the beginning of the Arminian controversy there in Holland. Because the Dutch people are characterized, I think, by whatever they do, you might say, to the extreme. If they are Calvinists, they are about the strongest Calvinists they are. If they are modernists, they're about the strongest modernists there are.
If they are Roman Catholics, they're about the most fanatical Roman Catholics there are. I remember in Germany, a man saying to me, he said, in Eastern Europe, everything is dirt. He said, in Germany, everything is very neat and clean. But he said, when you get to Holland, he said, you could eat your breakfast off the floor of the college table, everything is kept for spotless. I don't know whether it is a tendency of the people or what it is, but so long as they're for what is good, they do it often very excellently, but sometimes have a tendency to go to an extreme. And so you have the beginning of Arminianism, and you have a reaction against it in Holland, and you have in both directions, you have perhaps the extremes were there in Holland. Showed themselves at the beginning of this century, and that affected other countries. Now, in England, the Arminianism came to be a sort of a slogan used by the Anglo-Catholic Church. I have a book here written toward the end of the last century by an English ecclesiastic on the Church and the Puritans. And the Puritans to him are just about the worst thing there is, but it's a good historical book. He has a good presentation, and great many of the facts, but this idea that Laud has, he shows Laud's weaknesses, but his errors, rather, but he thinks Laud's ideals were just right. He praises Laud's attitude very, very strongly. But most histories, speaking of it, say that the Arminianism in the Church of England was really not so much like the Arminianism of Holland. It was really more of like the semi-Pelagianism of the Roman Catholic Church. That is, it is not so much as in Holland a discussion as to how God predestinated and why, as it is an attitude that puts stress on forms and ceremonies and on human development of character rather than on the grace of God. Now that really is not true Arminianism. But in England, the term Arminian came to be used for anything that was against Calvinism or against the Puritan. And so the big struggle came, which came in the succeeding years after the period at which we have just looked. Now, one other factor we should notice at the beginning of this century, which comes out very much during the first half century on the continent, and that is this. We have seen how the Counter-Reformation was developed in the last half of the 16th century. The first third of the 16th century, maybe the first half of it, the Romanist leaders all over Europe were mostly men who were simply interested in their own personal pleasures, their personal profits, their personal things. The church as a whole had fallen into great corruption and decay. And it is only after Lutheranism had made a real good start that they began developing leadership and developing a definite ideal and a strong effort to accomplish that. And the great force there was the foundation of the Jesuits, which was planned to be a military order to fight for the church. And so the Jesuits in the latter half of the century managed to take over Poland, in which a third of the people had become Protestant, and most of the nobility, they managed to very cleverly working, very skillfully, they managed to get control of Poland and practically eradicate Protestantism from it. And now at the end of the century, they were girding themselves to try to destroy Protestantism out of Europe. And so during the 17th century, we have what is known as the 30 Years' War, a war which ran from 1618 to 1648. And this was there are many factors that enter into it, but this was primarily a great effort of the Jesuit-directed forces to try to eradicate Protestantism from Europe. And it is greatly complicated by various political factors, but that was the cause of the war, that was the effort of the war. Now, one reason that they were able to get a good start in and able to conquer Austria and to conquer Bohemia and to eradicate Protestantism from these areas was that the Lutheran kingdom in northern Germany felt that these people were Calvinists, and they were not really strong with them at all. And the Calvinists, seeing this coming, were trying to persuade the Lutheran leaders to join with them in defending themselves, in preparing to defend themselves. But the Lutheran leaders had now their very strict Lutheran theology and were looking on Calvinists as almost worse than Romans. And the result was that the Jesuits were able to take them separately as two different groups at the start. But by the end of the war, or in fact before it had gone very long, the Lutheran leaders saw that it was an attack, not simply on Calvinism, but on all Protestantism. And soon, all of Central Europe was engulfed in this war that lasted for 30 years. Even Sweden was involved. If Sweden had not come, the Jesuits probably would have won out in a humanly speaking. On the other hand, King James's own daughter was married to the man who became king of Czechoslovakia. And James did not enter in and help. And so if he had, that might have ended it sooner. And then again, on the other side, Richelieu, seeing that the Austrian leaders might get pretty strong if they went out in Germany, he sent an army to help the Protestants in Germany. And very contradictory to his real ultimate aim, but for the advance of France. So you have a very involved situation. But by the end of it, you have the Peace of Augsburg extended so that Calvinism is recognized along with Lutheranism as a permitted religion in the empire. And you have at the end of it the southern part, Bohemia and Austria and Bavaria, completely in the Romanist hands. And remained so for some centuries after, so the gospel was completely ruled out from those areas. But you have in the northern section, things remain just as they were. So it was a terrible struggle. The greatest, perhaps, war in history, the previous Napoleonic War. And certainly one of the most devastating. But by the end of it, the way the different forces came in it, There was not much change except that Calvinism was now recognized along with Lutheranism. Well, we will stop there for this semester.